This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Obama is expected to address today's dramatic developments from the White House later this hour. When that happens, we'll take you there live. But the focus remains in Cairo, a city swept by jubilation as 2.5 weeks of tumultuous demonstrations finally forced the president from power. Many questions remain about who's in charge now, how long military rule there may continue, whether this is regime change or revolution. But let's go first to NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, who joins us from Tahrir Square, which has been the epicenter of this dramatic development since this demonstration started 2.5 weeks ago. Lourdes, can you tell us what's happening now?
Well, I'm hoping that you'll be able to hear me because it's so loud here and the phone lines are very bad. But there's just been an eruption of joy because the announcement was made that the Swiss Attorney General said it was freezing the accounts of some of the regime members, and that is a real vindication for the people here. I'm here with one of the protesters. I'm going to pass you, Amir Nashat, who is going to speak to you. He's a 30-year-old graduate student, and I will pass the phone, and he will tell you how he feels.
Hello.
Hello. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're feeling right now?
Well, actually, I smell freedom in the air. I'm so happy, and I really can't describe my feelings right now.
How?
It's amazing. It's just stunning what the youth has done here, and I'm really proud for being Egyptian.
And congratulations on what you've accomplished there. But tell us, how long have you been in Tahrir Square? How long do you expect to stay?
Well, I live abroad, actually. I came in yesterday. And I came to Tahrir Square yesterday and today in the morning, and I'm planning to stay the whole night here, celebrating and enjoying freedom.
And what do you expect to happen there in Cairo with the government over the next couple of days?
Well, with the government is still unclear, but what we all think that the army will take over for a transitional period. This is all what we hope until the government will be able to have free elections. For presidential elections in September, I hope.
And how quickly do you hope those elections take place?
Sorry?
How soon do you think those elections should take place?
Well, I would say right now I cannot confirm something like that, but I think there are very high chances that we will have free elections because since the beginning the army did not take over and did not want to use force against people. And it did not choose any side. It was neutral for the whole time. So I don't think that the army will take over and will turn into a police state. Plus what happened today between the speech yesterday that Mubarak gave and the speech that the army gave was completely contradicting. And it means that the army is still with the people and is not. It doesn't have any intention to take over.
And do you intend to now stay in your country, in Cairo, in Egypt?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you very much. Could you pass the phone back to our correspondent, please?
Yeah,
here. Hi, thank you so much.
And Lourdes, I'm not sure how much of that you were able to hear, but he addressed one of the critical questions. Is this going to be a temporary army council that holds power until free elections can be held, or is it going to turn into something, well, rather more extensive than that?
Well, that's exactly the question. I mean, certainly the older generation remembers very well what happened the last time when the army basically took over in a military coup and did not relinquish control. And people of the older generation are genuinely leery of that. The younger generation here, I have seen it the whole time. I mean, there has been fear, but they have a great deal of respect, and they really feel very strongly. The army has behaved very well throughout this. They have not interfered. They have maintained their position that they will not hurt the protesters. Now, of course, the relationship is going to be slightly different. It's the army that's apparently in control, and therefore the relationship between the people who started this revolution or this uprising and the army itself may be different. We have to see in the next few days. I have to tell you, though, people here are just overwhelmed, and it's very difficult to get a clear sense of what they want or where they want things to go. I've been asking them repeatedly, and they're just like, shut up, shut up. I just want to have a good time and party.
I can understand that. Yet it was just a week ago where that square was a scene of violence, and it looked as if this might spiral out of control. There were large numbers of pro-Mubarak demonstrators who were there challenging the anti-government demonstrators. Where are those people today?
Well, you know, they said all along that seemed to be, as they called them, pro-Mubarak thugs, people who were paid to come and agitate Democratic supporters in the days in the following days after that. So it's very difficult to know. Clearly, the regime has its supporters. Clearly, there are people who are going to be very concerned about what comes next and what this means for Egypt. People who are in the tourism industry, people who had vested interest in the many businesses of the regime. There are many people who will wonder, what will this mean for Egypt? But I can tell you right now, people are just enjoying the taste of the new country that they feel is emerging.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro with us from Tahrir Square, Liberation Square in Cairo, a place that will take on even a greater aspect in Egyptian history. Thank you very much, and we'll certainly keep in touch with you as the events unfold.
Okay.
And stay tuned to NPR News. We will be in constant contact with our correspondents in Egypt and bring you the latest as it develops. But let's come back here to the studio in Washington, D.C., and with us is NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins. Lauren, nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here, Neil.
And also with us here in the studio is Rachel Martin, NPR National Security Correspondent. Rachel, good of you to be with us.
Sure, Neil. Happy
and,
to be here.
Just a reminder, we're expecting President Obama to be with us from the White House later this hour, and unclear as yet exactly when he may be speaking, but when that happens, we'll go live to the White House. And NPR White House Correspondent Ari Shapiro also with us here in the studio. And Ari, nice of you to be with us.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Rachel Martin, what are we to make of the news that an army council has seized power in Egypt? Who are these people? What branches of the military do they come from? What are their interests?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we hear from all these people in the square, and they're using the word hope a lot. That's because things are still very much up in the air. This is essentially a military takeover. This is a military coup. These are primarily army. President Mubarak himself comes out of the Air Force. But this is largely an Egyptian army movement. And this is not at all a monolith. These the top echelon of the military, the general officer corps. These are people who are very tightly linked to Mubarak. Hussein Tantawi, he is effectively the chief of the Supreme Council. He's like our defense minister, like Secretary Robert Gates. And he's also wears the mantle of top military officer, so he's also the equivalent of Admiral Mike Mullen. He's the big guy. And he is effectively, although it hasn't been officially announced, in charge right now. What does all of this mean? He's got tight links to Mubarak. The lower you go down the ranks, it's unclear just exactly what the political predilections are. We haven't yet heard one way or the other how the mid-ranks are affected by all of this. This is a conscription force. Most people in Egypt have family members or no friends or themselves have served in the Egyptian army. That's why it's called, with some degree of affection, the People's Army. So what's going to happen right now in terms of how the army responds? Are these people likely to usher in a new era of democracy? It's really unclear at this point. There is no tradition of that in Egyptian history, that the military would just all of a sudden say, okay, we're done. Time for democracy.
And Lauren Jenkins, important to remember that the army in Egypt has vast economic influences and interests as well.
Absolutely. And they've all benefited, certainly the top generals have all benefited from the regime and from what Mubarak constructed and allowed to happen. A lot of money was spread around. The army has industries. They're everywhere in the society. They are totally ingrained in the society of Egypt.
And in agriculture, in industrial, and indeed, Sharm el-Sheikh, the great development of that port city into a resort, that is largely owned and operated by the Egyptian army.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think, you know, what this whole thing that's evolved, it answered some questions, like what's Mubarak going to happen to him, what his future is. But it raised a lot of other questions, which is what Rachel was talking about, is where does it go from here? The demonstrators are calling not just for Mubarak to step down. They were calling for a regime change, to wipe away the whole institutions of state that were built by the dictatorship that Mubarak presided over. They want the parliament to be cashiered because it was elected fraudulently last year. They want the emergency laws to be lifted. They want to see new institutions, a new constitution. The constitution that people talk about is an invalid document now. I mean, they've already broken it by having the transfer of power they had this morning. So they want to see a new constitution that brings them liberty, freedoms, elections.
Also worth pointing out quickly, Neil,
Rachel Martin,
Hussein Tantawi, the head of the armed forces, is also the deputy prime minister. I mean, Mubarak elevated him and put him in his political inner circle in recent weeks as kind of a concession that he was spreading around the power. But he is very closely linked to the president himself.
And Lauren Jenkins, all of this is going to take considerable time. You don't write a constitution overnight. You don't establish political parties and mount election campaigns overnight. Elections were scheduled to be held in September. Some people might say, well, that needs to be moved up. You can't have these people stay in power too long. Power, as we know, becomes addictive.
Actually, it's going to probably be moved back because this whole society, before you could have elections, you have to, one, get a new constitution to lay down the ground rules of how you have the elections. You have to give Egypt time to organize political parties to participate in the elections. They don't have political parties. They were all banned except for a few token parties that were sort of trotted out to say this is a democracy when it wasn't.
And in the last parliamentary elections, what was it, 95% of the votes went to the president's party.
Exactly.
As we've seen, well, anytime anybody gets 95% of the votes, it's almost guaranteed that something fishy is going on. As you look ahead, though, to the next few days, we saw several suggestions that there be, in addition to this army council, a council of wise men, political figures, Mohammed El-Baradei, the Nobel Prize winner, as the head of the IAEA, and though he spent as much of his life in Vienna, is that going to be a possibility to emerge, to be in consultation with the army council?
Well, it's a possibility. It all depends really, what we don't know is just what the army intends. Right now, we know they've taken power. They've pushed Mubarak out. They've obviously listened to the demonstrators. They are aware of how powerful they are. But we don't know what they really want, how they plan to do it, or even if they're united. There were indications yesterday. It's taken 24 hours for this to evolve. Indications they were splits within the military and the High Council. And so it depends who's going to come out on top.
NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins, also with us. Rachel Martin, NPR National Security Correspondent. When we come back from a short break, we'll also be speaking with Ari Shapiro, NPR White House Correspondent, as we await President Obama's remarks on this. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Special Coverage from NPR News. This is Special Coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you've been away from the news of the day, well, it's been a dramatic day in Egypt. President Hosni Mubarak has left the capital and resigned all of his offices and all of his power. He is now believed to be at a presidential palace in the Sinai Desert. There is a military council now in charge in Cairo. We're going to take you there now. NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson is in Cairo overlooking Tahrir Square, where hundreds of thousands of demonstrators are thronging to celebrate the announcement that they've been waiting for so long. And we heard, Soraya, just a few minutes ago, scenes of ecstasy, scenes of celebration, scenes of we'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes, but let us savor this moment right now.
Absolutely. I mean, you can hear the cars honking all the way back to, other neighborhoods just far, far away. We heard fireworks earlier. There are all sorts of people running through the streets. The barricades have been taken down that have surrounded Tahrir Square, which, of course, has been the flashpoint for these protests since January 25th. And people are just celebrating in a way that there's such release here. You could feel it. It's almost palpable in the air.
Yet have you heard anything about plans for a transfer of power?
Nothing at this stage, other than the announcement from Vice President Omar Suleiman that the president was stepping down and that he had ceded power to the military's high command. There hasn't been anything. We were expecting a statement from the military, but at this point, it seems that whoever's in charge is sort of stepping back, and the military certainly is stepping back and letting people just have this release and this celebration, if you will. They are there, and the presence is there, but again, they have sort of moved back. They're not coming forward now saying, okay, that's enough, it's time for people to go home. It'll be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. But at this stage, no one seems to be thinking about a lot of the other demands that they have that remain unfulfilled. I mean, again, as Lauren Jenkins had said earlier, there has to be a regime change. That is what the people want. It's not just a matter of a personality. And there's still a big question about what happens with the parliament, what happens with the cabinet, what happens with the vice president, for that matter.
And do we know that the whether clearly the people in the square down below you have been the engine of all of this change. Has a leadership emerged there, a new force in Egyptian politics?
Not yet. I mean, there are certainly people who are coming forward and who are expressing an interest in taking on that mantle, but it's very young. I mean, most of the parties have, what parties were here, there were token parties in opposition, but they're not very strong. And these, certainly these youth groups, they formed a loose coalition, but even these opposition members, people like Mr. El-Baradei and others who have sort of come forward, they're not even in agreement yet on what it is they want. I mean, they have to establish sort of a platform. They have to establish parties. They have to come up with a plan, if you will. And Mr. El-Baradei told NPR's Robert Siegel earlier that he thinks that even elections which are technically scheduled, the presidential elections are scheduled for September, that that's just way too early, that it's going to take a year at least in order to get to the point where you can do that.
And is there any indication yet as to what the Muslim Brotherhood may be interested in doing? They are generally regarded as the one political force that is well organized, in part because they've been so repressed over the years that they've established a resilient structure that is able to withstand the kind of pressures that were brought against them by the 30-year Mubarak dictatorship.
They've been very firm throughout this two-and-a-half-week ordeal here, saying that taking a backseat role, not being active in any kind of leadership role, taking part in some talks initially with the government, but those didn't go anywhere either. And they say they're not going to run a candidate. But as you say, they do have some power here. I mean, back in the 2005 parliament, which ended last year, they managed to collect 20% of the seats, even though they're a banned political movement. But they had independents who were elected and who were aligned with that movement and created basically an opposition force. But analysts that I've spoken to have said that they weren't exactly a stellar politicians, if you will. So even the Brotherhood, while they have popular support, I mean, what's lacking here is really sort of an experienced political movement, if you will. All that has to be established from the ground up.
Saraya Serhadi Nelson, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we'll be continuing to be in touch with you as developments continue. In the meantime, joining us now is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. Senator Kerry, good of you to be with us.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
And can we get your reaction to the events today in Cairo?
Well, the events today in Cairo are obviously monumental. It's a moment not unlike the fall of the Berlin Wall for the Middle East. It's tectonic, and the key now is really to make certain that the institution building and the open, accountable election necessary to legitimacy for anyone going forward, that that takes place very, very quickly, visibly, transparently, and accountably to the people. If not, they will be back into the streets. So there's a lot of work yet to be done, but I think the most significant thing is really that, you know, this is a government that's brought, this is a people who brought about transition without Al-Qaeda, without Muslim Brotherhood, without bombs in the streets, without IEDs. These are people who expressed an aspiration and had the courage to go out in a peaceful way and make it happen. To me, that's the most dramatic and lasting component of this.
Yet, as we know, their aspirations go considerably beyond the removal simply of President Mubarak. They go to the change of an entire regime, to the entire structure that maintained him in power all of these years.
Absolutely. And that is why I said the key is now the next days to see how the military responds to this demand. Will they put those institutions in place? Will they lift the martial law? Will they move rapidly to empower the formation of parties and candidacies? Will they really move down a democratic road and allow the will of the people to be heard? That still hangs in the balance here.
And what is the role of the United States at this moment?
The role of the United States is to make clear those necessities, to make clear what the ingredients of the process are, and to make available our help and the help of other countries to assist them in that transition. For instance, I was talking just earlier today with people involved in the Central European and in the emergence of countries after the Soviet Union fell. You know, there are people from the Czech Republic, for instance, are prepared to go and explain how you do affect this transition and how you move from totalitarianism into democracy. I think there are a lot of folks around who can be enormously helpful, and our role is to help coalesce that and to hope, try to create a roadmap, if you will, without, and this is very important, making it an overbearing kind of foreign presence and, you know, opening up any accusations of trying to hijack the thing.
Senator Kerry, as we're speaking, a spokesman for the Egyptian military command is suggesting that thanking President Mubarak for all of his service to the Egyptian people over the years, but also suggesting that the elections may be moved up, accelerated. Do you think that's wise at this moment?
Well, it depends which elections, the election for president, the election for parliament, and certainly don't move them up too much. That would not be wise, because if you move them up too much, you're clearly favoring established entities of one kind or another, and that would do a disservice to what has taken place. So I think it's very, very important that that there be wisdom as to sort of what rate, what process takes place. On the other hand, if they lift the martial law and the internet and other forms of communication are open and the press is a legitimate press, not managed and run by the military on a daily basis, a lot of communication could take place very quickly. So I just think we have to sort of feel that one out a little bit as we go forward in the next days. We will have serious contacts with their military. We already do. We have been over the last days. And I'm very confident that we will push hard for some kind of reasonableness, as will the Egyptian people, incidentally.
The United States aid, well over $1 billion a year to Egypt, has largely been military aid. Should the character of that aid change, and should that aid at any point be held, you may not be comfortable with this word, but be held hostage to various kinds of developments there?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to sort of lump it out there in the first days and in this moment. There are parties in the Mideast who are prepared to make up any difference of our aid very quickly for certain purposes that you can understand. So I don't think that it's as big a lever as one might think. It also, I'm not sure, is the right way to proceed, although at some point in time, depending on the choices that they make, clearly it will become part of the equation, inevitably, depending on those choices.
Senator Kerry, thank you very much for your time today. And
thanks.
We look forward to hearing from you in the days ahead. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With me in the studio are Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, Rachel Martin, NPR national security correspondent, and Ari Shapiro, NPR White House correspondent. We're expecting President Obama. We were expecting President Obama to make some remarks about the situation in Egypt at about this time. We're now told that will be delayed. For how long? We don't know. When we find out, we'll let you know. In the meantime, let me turn to Lauren Jenkins and to Ari Shapiro. As you just heard Senator Kerry say, of course, the United States celebrates this, but the United States has been sending, mixed signals at best. Ari, yes, we're all for the people in the streets. We're all for democracy. We're all for stability, too.
You know, every time President Obama opens his mouth on this issue, he's speaking to so many different constituencies. He's speaking to the people who are living under dictatorships, not just in Egypt, but around the world. He is speaking to some of those very dictators who are strong American allies, who he doesn't want to alienate. He's speaking to the people of the United States, to whom he wants to sound consistent. And so as a result, you've had this bifurcated message where the president, the secretary of state, the press secretary, and everyone else have said, this is going to be in the hands of the Egyptian people. We support anyone who aspires to democracy. At the same time, they don't want to alienate this strong, stable force. Egypt is really a linchpin, both for the Middle East and for Africa. And, you know, while they would love to see democracy, they also love stability. And it's really important to them that what comes next not be a chaotic force in that very important region of the world.
Well, Lauren Jenkins, clearly the army would represent stability, but would it represent the kind of change that the people of Egypt are demanding?
Well, I think that's the big question, and that's a question we're going to be seeing the next days and weeks and months, just how they go about ruling and what they offer in terms of changing the structure of governance in Egypt. Right now, that's a question we don't know. We don't even know if Vice President Suleiman, who was just got his job last week, is still in power. If Mubarak turned over all of his powers to the military council, that would seem to negate his real role unless they reappoint him or choose to reappoint him. So we don't even know who's in charge except this council right now.
He was, before he became vice president, head of military intelligence, though,
exactly.
So not exactly unfamiliar with the military power structure. Rachel?
Well, and also, you know, Senator Kerry mentioned something interesting. The military this morning said that they will lift the emergency law when the protesters go home. So this is like a major game of chicken. Who's gonna blink first? Are the protesters gonna believe that this is actually gonna happen and disperse? And they have yet to do it. It's been several hours. That could have been something very easy, a major concession that could have been made earlier in the day, and we haven't seen that yet.
Let's find out a little bit more about the Egyptian military from Robert Springboard, a professor at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He joins us from his office there in San Francisco. Professor Springboard, thanks very much for your time this evening.
Thanks for having me.
And the Egyptian military, as we've heard, has been relatively non-confrontational. There was a moment early on when protesters said, they're on our side, they're not forcing us from Tahrir Square. There was a moment that he said, wait a minute, we're not so sure. They're also letting in the pro-Mubarak demonstrators who are throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at us. Yet now the Egyptian military has taken command and has forced the president from power. What are they going to do now?
Well, we've just heard that they would like to hold elections quickly. What they mean by that is presidential elections. So they are obviously purposely excluding the idea of a constitutional reform. The present constitution has 35 articles, more than any other constitution in the world that I'm aware of, that assign power to the president. So the military is suggesting that it wants to have a strong president and presumably, therefore, one that's acceptable to it. I think they have their candidate already. I believe that is Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister. And I think the military would breathe a great sigh of relief if the transition took the form of an election for the presidency under the current constitution and that the successful candidate was Amr Moussa, who has worked his whole life with the Egyptian military and is not about ready to challenge its fundamental privileges and its powers. Question will be, is that going to be the game plan accepted by the opposition or not?
In a couple of minutes, we have to go to the White House, where President Obama will be speaking. Yeah. Oh, 3 p.m. I'm sorry. I thought you said 3 minutes. In any case, so we have a little bit more time with you, Professor. But I wanted to ask you, we think of a military in this country as a force whose job it is to fight and win wars. What is the job of the Egyptian military?
Well, it has been to support the president. Its force structure remains frozen in time back in the 1970s. A lot of equipment's been added it can't use, and it has no intent of using. It hasn't modernized in command control. It hasn't diversified its missions. It hasn't integrated into other friendly armed forces the capacity to work with them. It's not performing humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. In short, the military was there to support the president and do nothing else. And so it's now time for the military to confront the moment of truth. It needs to be modernized in the appropriate ways and be subject to civilian control. They're going to fight that, and that's going to be a huge issue to come. Runner off the blocks here is clearly the military. It's got a plan. It's not constitutionally empowered, by the way. Just because Mubarak gave the military power doesn't mean that is a violation of the Constitution. So now the opposition has to think long and hard, how are they going to play with the military? And there will be different views on that, so it's a lot of tricky times ahead here.
The military also has an enormous stake in Egypt's economy, such as it is now.
Well, that's right, and this is a big problem because previous speakers on this program and others have from Egypt have been saying, well, now is the time to investigate look into the hollow logs where the money might be kept. Well, many of those hollow logs involve mixed dealings between the military and civilians connected with Mubarak or Mubarak himself. And so to investigate the the transgressions of the regime is to take it directly into the military economy. And this is precisely the institution over which the Field Marshal, General Tantawi, who is now chair of this Supreme Military Committee, presides. So he has less than zero interest in having an investigation of that. So it's a whole other area of problems that confront Egypt today.
And can you give us a brief sketch of just how big a role in Egypt's economy the military plays?
No one knows exactly. I've heard GDP figures ranging from 3 to 30%, but it's all wild speculation because from about 1990, the military has drawn a veil over the economy over which it presides. And so it's really impossible to calculate what its total contribution is, but we know it employs hundreds of thousands of people. It ranges from services of a touristic or telecommunications nature into direct production of goods such as appliances, as well as, of course, military hardware. It's one of the biggest construction arms in the country. So it's a massive, far-flung enterprise and produces absolutely zero figures to the parliament or to the general accounting organization. So we just don't know how big it truly is.
Professor Springborg, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Robert Springborg, a professor at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and he joined us from his office there in San Francisco. Earlier we heard from John Kerry, senator from Massachusetts, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. With us is Lauren Jenkins, NPR senior foreign editor, Rachel Martin, NPR national security correspondent, Ari Shapiro, the White House correspondent, who has told us we can expect to hear from President Obama in about an hour and 20 minutes. So we'll bring you to the White House live when that happens. I'm Neil Conan. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Hosni Mubarak stepped down from his office today and has left the Capitol and gone to a presidential palace near Sharm el-Sheikh in the Sinai Desert. We're expecting later today President Obama to be speaking about the situation in Egypt and about the dramatic developments that have unfolded. With me here in the studio in Washington, NPR senior foreign editor Lauren Jenkins and NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro. Ari, as you look forward to the president's remarks, we heard a little bit from the vice president earlier today, but clearly he did not want to preempt anything his boss might have to say.
Right. Vice President Biden more or less limited his comments to saying it's a historic day for the people in Egypt. Now, I'm generally not a betting man, but Neil, I would bet you money that whatever we hear from the president today will include the phrase free, fair, and credible elections. And I say that partly because virtually every statement that every member of Congress, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, that everybody has put out has said the most important thing now is to set the timetable for free, fair, and credible elections. It was a huge step to get President Mubarak to leave office. There are many huge steps left. And one of the things that Senator Kerry said to you that really struck me is you were asking him just a few moments ago, why doesn't the U.S. use the billions of dollars in aid that it gives Egypt as leverage? Senator Kerry's response was, because if we pull that money away, there are lots of others who would love to fill in that gap. And he didn't name Iran specifically, but this moment of opportunity for the Egyptian people is also a moment of opportunity for a lot of actors that the U.S. does not want to take advantage of that opportunity. And so it's a narrow balancing act that President Obama has to do right now.
And we'll get back to that in just a moment. But it's also a political moment for the president of the United States. Shellacked, as he put it, in midterm elections just a few months ago. Well, something of a rebound since then. A very well-received speech in Tucson, a very well-received State of the Union address. He made some important deals with the lame duck session of Congress, but this is a week when he could have expected to be lambasted by the CPAC Conference of Conservatives here in Washington, D.C. He could look forward to a major battle on the budget beginning on Monday. Yet this is a moment where the president of the United States stands alone.
It has been incredible. Just to take the 10,000-foot view, if you look after that shellacking, as the president described it, there was the lame duck session where it was one legislative victory after another. There was the eulogy in Tucson, which was universally praised even by a majority of Republicans. There was the State of the Union address, which received an incredibly positive reception across the political spectrum. And now, over the last 2 weeks, as this situation in Egypt has unfolded, you've seen a little bit of criticism, but on the whole, Republicans and Democrats have held their fire. Republicans have held their fire, and Democrats have applauded President Obama for his handling of the situation in Egypt. And now you see President Mubarak leave President Obama, I think, is going to, if not take credit for it, at least appear in a position of authority, of dignity, of the voice of reason. And as you mentioned, there is a lot going on in the news that we would have been paying attention to but for Egypt that might not make President Obama look so good. At the CPAC conservative conference this morning, Mitt Romney gave a speech where he said that President Obama has this affect of conciliatory bipartisanship that masks his true liberal philosophy. Well, we're not hearing about that speech because of Egypt, the budget battles that are brewing as President Obama rolls out his 2012 fiscal year budget on Monday, and the Republicans propose much deeper cuts in the budget. All of that is just being wiped aside because of the incredible images coming out of Cairo right now.
And Lauren Jenkins, it's also important to remember, and perhaps President Carter might remind him, that there are moments when new revolutionary movements sweep into power that can not redound positively to the president of the United States, and questions could yet emerge, depending on what happens in Egypt, as to who lost Egypt, but that's down the road. Nevertheless, as Ari was speaking, there are other people here, other players, who may see opportunities, beginning with Iran.
Well, I think that the Iran thing is maybe a little overstretched because the two countries are so different. And this isn't a religious revolution. This is a people's revolution. It's a democratic revolution. It's people of all walks of life, Muslim brothers as well as even the Christian Copts are involved in this. It's a cross-section of an Egyptian population that's had enough of dictatorship, and they're trying to express it, and they're trying to change it, so far quite successfully. The Iran issue, which was very much a religious movement organized against the Shah, had a leadership, had a destination, and they knew where they were going. I think this is something totally new and different. Interestingly enough, what I think is lost in this, this is a place, Egypt, Cairo is a place President Obama went to make his first foreign speech. It's where he tried to bridge the gap and link America to the new forces in the Arab world against the dark forces of al-Qaeda and the idea that everything was either stability and dictatorship or chaos and Muslim Brotherhood or worse, al-Qaeda. We're identifying, and his challenge is to identify with the Egyptian public and to show we do care as a nation and we do support the forces of reform and the forces of democracy. And this is a real challenge to what al-Qaeda was offering. Al-Qaeda was gaining ground and succeeding because of the split between regimes and their people and being the only alternative being offered to the people how to get some of these regimes off your back. Now the people have risen up and done it without al-Qaeda, without violence, without, as Senator Kerry said, without IEDs. This is an extraordinary peaceful expression of a people.
This event began unfolding as a reaction to events in Tunisia. And in Tunisia, again, a long-term president forced out of office, forced out of the country, indeed. Yet there seems to be a transition attempt to be underway, which is very much keeping the old regime in power, new players shuffled around from the previous regime. How is that playing out, and could that be a model for what's going on?
Well, I think we're going to see that. All the old players aren't gone. We still have the Constitution, the Mubarak Constitution in place. We still have the emergency laws. We still have a phony parliament in place. There are going to be struggles. There are still people that haven't left the government of Mubarak and allowed a whole new government to come in. I think that's the challenge we're waiting for, to see how the military handles this. And are they going to open the doors and allow some of these expressions and demands to be met or go back to the old order? And that's the question we'll see answered in the days to come.
Ari Shapiro, how much does the president say the United States has a role in this? How much credit does he want to take for it? And how much responsibility does he in fact have?
He's going to argue that the United States' role is, has been, and will continue to be one of supporting the will of the Egyptian people. You heard President Mubarak just yesterday say that he's resisting outside forces, that he's not going to give in to pressure from foreigners. The U.S. has been trying very, very hard to make sure this does not look like a revolution fomented by the United States and other foreigners. And the president's message has always been, we stand behind the Egyptian people, this will be decided by the Egyptian people, and we want to support the Egyptian people in whatever they decide. That's going to continue to be his message, and I think the role he will argue that the U.S. needs to play in that is helping to ensure that the Egyptian people's will can be addressed. You know, over the last couple of weeks, we've heard this debate unfolding over whether what's happening in Tunisia and Egypt validates the Bush administration's foreign policy approach of nurturing democracy wherever it might possibly flourish, or the Obama administration's approach going to Cairo and, you know, reaching out even to dictators. And somebody I spoke to said, it's like arguing over whose foreign policy approach validates the law of gravity. The fact is, when people are oppressed long enough and rulers don't listen to the will of their citizens long enough, the people and the citizens will eventually have their say, no matter who the American president is or what they do.
And Lauren Jenkins, that then asks the question about other people in other Arab countries where there have been longtime monarchies and dictatorships installed. What's going to happen in Saudi Arabia? What's going to happen in Jordan? What's going to happen in Syria?
Well, they had some efforts to demonstrate in Syria last week, and they were quickly put down. The secret police there are still pretty strong, and the people are still pretty timid in Syria. Saudi Arabia is a different question. We have a correspondent, Deb Amos, is in Saudi Arabia right now, and what she's reporting to us is that they're all watching what's going on in Egypt very closely, but there's no sense there that that's going to spread into Saudi Arabia. Again, it doesn't have the population mass of an Egypt, and the controls of the royal family are much stronger and more traditional and historic. I think Jordan is a place where you could see this spreading. In Bahrain on Monday, they've declared a day of rage against the Sunni king who rules a Shiite majority population. Yemen has had big demonstrations against another ruler who's been dictatorial and in place for decades. So it's possible to see it spread, but it's hard to predict anything at this point.
There has been much talk about the role of, brand new media, Facebook and Twitter, in organizing these rebellions. But, Lauren, you and I both go back a fair amount of years in the Middle East when most of the media there were state-run newspapers that World Events came out several days late. Everything was very much controlled by the government. It was every newscast led with 10 minutes on the activities of the royal family that day and who they'd seen and what they'd done. This is a new world. Al Jazeera and other media have completely transformed all of that aspect of it. That cannot be controlled anymore.
No, I think you're right. I think much more than Facebook and Twitter. I think it's the satellite televisions that have developed Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, who now reach every country, and no government can control the news anymore.
Joining us now on the phone from Cairo is Imad Shaheen, an associate professor of religion, conflict, and peacebuilding at the University of Notre Dame. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And can you tell us where you are?
Well, I just came back from Tahrir Square just to get some rest, and in exactly 5 minutes, I'm heading back again to the square just to continue. I needed to get some rest, so I was all day in Tahrir Square.
And what is it? It almost sounds like you need to be there as much as you need food or air or water.
Exactly. Right, because, you know, most people, you know, just you are camping, are staying there, especially after Mubarak's statement last night when he refused to step down. Frustrating people's anticipation and expectations. So actually, most of them were resolved that they would not leave before Mubarak leaves. So that was the slogan, we're not leaving before Mubarak leaves. So everybody, you know, there are so many people, of course, you know, over maybe close to 1 million and a half. And we were all resolved, actually, to stay until Mubarak left.
And now that Mubarak has left, what happens next? Everybody wants that question answered.
Well, of course, this was one of the scenarios that was actually circulating, that there might be some kind of a military takeover or intervention or whatever. The military would step in order to and assume power itself in order to prevent some kind of a direct bloody confrontation between the military establishment and the rest of the population and the protesters. So this is one, especially in light of the absence of some kind of a consensual or an agreed upon candidate by the opposition, and also a clear agenda about the ways to move forward. So this was one of the scenarios that the military would step in. This is exactly happened. However, a few minutes ago, the spokesperson of the military high council or supreme council came on television and announced that the military's he confirmed the military's commitment to work within the confines of legitimacy and also not to frustrate the people's desire for legitimate political goals and future.
Yet he also
said
he also said the military hoped to move up, accelerate elections, and that suggests that the elections may be held before the opposition can be truly organized.
Well, I mean, usually in situations like this, usually there's some kind of a reasonable time frame during which some of the first steps, of course, that the military would suspend the constitution and, of course, dismiss parliament and, of course, prepare for some kind of a transition during which a new constitution would be written and maybe preparations for elections, parliamentary and presidential would take place. But again, this is very difficult to anticipate. We don't know which scenario this might take. We can follow the Algerian scenario. We can follow the Turkish scenario where the military might agree to step back and just operate or function as a watchdog for a democratic process taking place in the country. So we still don't know what's going to happen, but all the kind of assurances that we heard from the military through its different statements, in fact, stress the fact that the military understands the legitimate demands of the Egyptian people and would work to fulfill them. So hopefully it will carry through on its promises.
This is, nevertheless, as we worry about what may happen in the days and weeks and months ahead, this is, nevertheless, we can't forget, a moment of extraordinary achievement and celebration for the Egyptian people.
It's a major victory. It's a major victory of the Egyptian people. And as one could say, this is the first time that the Egyptians got rid of their pharaoh peacefully. And also, this is the first time the Egyptians learned how to stay and live without the state for at least three weeks or 1 month. It's really a historical moment.
If there has been one moment that you experienced in Tahrir Square since you arrived there yesterday that moved you, can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's an old man who came to the square, and actually there were so many stories and really horrifying stories. And this old man, people asked him, why are you taking the trouble? He said, because during Mubarak's age, I had to sell my kidney to feed my children. So I'm here coming to protest and get my right back.
My gosh, there are any number of stories like that. That's a very dramatic one.
Huge stories.
Can you imagine this force dissipating, this new courage that has been accepted by the people, this new responsibility that has been accepted by the people?
I hope not, because, look, this is unprecedented in all levels. Even the people themselves, when they heard about, this military takeover, I expressed some concerns. As a political scientist, I'd rather see society, pursuing its own and charting its own course of political and social development. And I don't like any kind of, like a higher council taking charge and so on, especially a military one. But people said, listen, we have tasted freedom, and we are capable of doing this again. So if the military does not deliver, we will take the streets again. That's exactly the kind of resolve. So this is, the type of change and the spirit that this revolt or revolution has instilled into the Egyptian people over the past weeks, that they have tasted the freedom and empowered themselves, and they are willing to repeat this again.
We have heard from so many people in the last couple of weeks about that they have, in a sense, been almost embarrassed to call themselves Egyptians over the past many years, and that all of that has changed. Would you count yourself in that number?
I have always been proud to be Egyptian, and I've never lost faith. I know this is not in hindsight, but look, I'm a teacher, and all my life I taught politics. And my job was to always keep the hope alive, even if I was, losing it. I couldn't, even reflect that on my students, because all the students have always been for me the agents of change. And thank God that I live to see this day.
One final question, and we'll let you go back to Tahrir Square. That is, if everybody goes home, if life gets back to something approaching normal, would you be afraid that this kind of momentum could not be recaptured again?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I hope, you know, like, the people have actually, the demonstrators and protesters and the political forces in Egypt over the past actually 8 years have managed to develop a very clear agenda of reform. And they know exactly what they are standing for and what they are hoping for. And it's very clear. Even the military itself, in its different statements, echoed these legitimate demands. They are aware of these legitimate demands. The idea of transitional government, the idea of freedom of speech, the idea of freedom of assembly, the idea of independent judiciary, effective constitution. They are aware of this. So hopefully they carry through and they will deliver as they promised.
Imad Shaheen, thank you very much for your time today. We know it's a very emotional moment for you. He's an associate professor of religion, conflict, and peacebuilding at the University of Notre Dame. Stay tuned to NPR for continuing special coverage of dramatic events as they unfold in Egypt. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.